Every lecture has its peculiar history. This one began in an airport waiting for a snow-delayed plane. As often and on such occasions you cast about for any scrap of paper to read, I found the local afternoon newspaper and I began reading at the beginning and I read it through to the end. It seems that in this town there was a columnist, and this columnist had decided to go to Israel, and in Israel he had discovered that the Israelis aren't Jews. He'd written a rather breathless column to this effect. His proof? Well, he'd been in the bar of the Don Hotel, and an old grizzled reporter who'd been there all of 2 weeks had told him that the Israelis weren't Jews. He said, "You ought to hear these people talk about politics, about sex, about American Jews. Scare your pants off." And he'd gone out to prove the case, and he had been standing in front of the Israel Museum when a busload of American tourists had been dropped off, and a young Israeli had been standing beside him, and he'd drawn this Israeli into conversation. And the Sabra had said to him, "They're Jews, I'm an Israeli." And it seems that this columnist kept his job by creating newspaper tempests and teapots. And he had a rather conspiratorial conclusion to the effect that there was an undertaking in Israel, managed by the Jewish Agency and other official groups, to see to it that visitors to Israel didn't get to see ordinary Israelis, because it might ruffle some feathers which otherwise needed to be plucked. Now, Israelis are different. They were meant to be. You go back to the very first Zionist literature, the first Zionist writings of the middle of the 19th century, Moses Hess, Pinsker, and later Nordau, and Achad Ha'am, and Theodor Herzl. You'll see very quickly that Zionism was not simply a movement designed to bring the Jew out of Galut, out of the dispersion, but to bring a movement designed to bring the dispersion, the Galut, out of the Jew. Zionists felt that there was something which was demeaning to the Jew in his statelessness, in his insecurity. He was bowed. He was cowed. He was always glancing over his shoulder. He was always worried, Ma yomru hagoyim, what will be the reaction of my non-Jewish neighbors if I make this statement or that, if I do this or that? His life was circumscribed by a radar system, keenly attuned to the feelings of the larger community. He could not be himself. One of the glories that was looked forward to in a Jewish state was the opportunity for a Jew to be natural, to be himself, not to worry about all of the possible consequences and subsequences of what he might say. So the Israeli was meant to be different, but whether he was meant to be as different as he is today, that's another question. Those of you who've been to Israel, and I know most of you have, know that it doesn't count at all to be a lady. You lug your own suitcase, you fight for your own place in line, you know that in conversation, nobody is careful of your sensitivities, of stepping on your toes. They're very blunt. They're very direct. Hebrew phrase is yashar la'inyan, to go straight to the matter. Durga, to be precise in what one wants to say without equivocation. Fancy talk, diplomatic talk, embroidered talk belongs to us. We diaspora Jews, we're past masters at being vocal. The Israeli likes to think of himself as a rather silent type, who when he speaks, speaks directly to the point. Free men stand up, they say what has to be said, and then that's the end of it, fertig. You can talk in the diaspora, we don't have time. We work, we say, And we do. Now, many who have been to Israel are shocked by the lack of manners, by the directness of speech, by the opinions of Israelis. And their opinions are forceful, and sometimes when we disagree with them, they seem to be us to be opinionated. And our expressions sometimes make us wonder what it is that binds us anymore. A French voyager, a sociologist who went to Israel seeking his own roots. He was one of those European Jews who had been 101% Frenchman until Vichy. He came away from Israel saying this: a new people is being created every day in Israel, a young people that is neither an appendage nor the center of the now legendary Jewish people. He found there a new, unexpected model. An American anthropologist who went to stay in Israel for some time to study the children and child rearing in a particular kibbutz, a man by the name of Melford Spiro, wrote this just about 3 years ago. In effect, he said, the Sabras, the native-born, feel no tie other than a negative one with much of Jewish tradition or with particularly Jewish values. They want little to do with the last 2,000 years of the Jewish past, and they wish to disassociate themselves from those Jews who actively or symbolically represent those values or that past. And as I'm sure you know, there has been a tiny, very vocal minority in Israel who have labeled themselves Canaanites, who refuse the label Jew. They call themselves contemporary pagans. They insist that they are children of the land, as the Canaanites were native to the land, that Judaism and Jewishness are diaspora characteristics, that to be natural, one must chuck this whole tradition over. Begin again in the time of Joshua and the Judges, when men we were tillers of the soil, and when we brought the water with our own labor from the soil. And that is what civilization is all about. But how different are the Israelis? Obviously, that's only one side of the coin. Most of us, when we visit Israel, recognize so much in Israel which is familiar to us, which speaks of our tradition. The gray land is green. The parched land is fertile. Why? Because we have husbanded it and worked it and cared for it. Torah is learning. We know that respect for the mind is one of the immortal traditions and virtues of our Jewish people. And we see in Israel a great school system, fine high schools, the Hebrew University, the Technion, Tel Aviv University, Bar Ilan. And we know that the Israeli has not neglected the mind. He has not become the pagan, the mindless child of the soil. And we know that our people have always emphasized the social justice tradition, the prophetic tradition of our people. And we look at the kibbutzim, the one truly effective communal socialist community existing in the world within a democratic setting. And we know that the Israelis have not neglected the prophetic tradition. How different are the Israelis? Interestingly, probably and by one of those strange coincidences, when I came back from this trip, I found on my desk a book by an old and dear friend, which is the first attempt to understand critically just how different the Israelis are. What ties Israelis, particularly the Sabras, the native-born, feel to the Jewish people. Simon Herman is a professor of social relations at the Institute for Contemporary Jewish Studies at the Hebrew University. He's a South African Jew educated under Kurt Lewin in New York City at the New School for Social Research. He's a sweet, lovely, brilliant man. And he studied the first generation of Sabras born under independence. He studied those young men and women who had been born in 1948. And this book called Israelis and Jews, A Study in Continuity, is an attempt to understand just how they see themselves within this continuum which we call the Jewish people. And as always with a critical study, we find things which we do not expect. We understand things perhaps more clearly. We recognize that the issue is far more complex than we had ever imagined it to be. He says in the first instance that diaspora Jews, Jews from Western Europe, from Latin America, from the United States, who visit Israel, tend to judge one's place on this continuum which we call the Jewish history, Jewish people, one's willingness to be part of the community by the degree of religious identification. To us, Judaism is primarily a religious people, a people who have no respect for the religious traditions, who are active atheists, who deliberately withhold themselves from the synagogue, simply in our minds do not fit easily within this continuum. And there is, he points out very clearly, there is a strong, marked decline in religious identification among these young Sabras. On the other hand, what we often do not see because we are not there to see, there is a strong minority, far more sizable than in the diaspora, who have maintained and do maintain in an ever-strengthening way the entire burden of the tradition. Some 20% of the Sabras in Israel are Dati, Orthodox traditionalist. And unlike what we might expect, they do not simply grow up in Orthodox families and then disappear from these families into the larger community. But because the Orthodox, the Dati community in Israel, has organized its own Orthodox schools, its own traditionalist high schools, its own traditionalist youth movements, its own traditionalist kibbutzim, these young people from their birth are surrounded and reinforced in their identifications by an effective, vital, and to them meaningful Jewish experience, fully traditional. And they come into their maturity convinced that this is the way that Israel must go. And since the Orthodox experience for them is defined largely in terms of the Eastern European tradition, the yeshivot of Poland, the yeshivot of Russia and of Hungary, to the traditionalist of America, the traditionalist young people in Israel seem very similar. They do not fit the stereotype of the cocky young man in cocky shorts with cocky voice whom we sometimes think the Sabra must be. And beyond these Ashkenazic Dati, these Ashkenazic religious young people, there is the larger segment of Oriental Jews. Today, nearly 50% of all the native-born youngsters under 21 years of age are from Oriental Jewish families. An Oriental Jewry, the Jewry of Persia, the Jewry of Iraq, the Jewry of Yemen, the Jewry of Egypt, the Jewry of North Africa, had no experience with secularism, with humanism, and with modernism, with all the things which have infected Europe in these last two centuries. They came to Israel as clans, as members of an intense extended family. They have maintained in Israel these intricate ties, this web of family relationships. It's very hard for them to break out from it, even if they wish to. If they do, the break tends to be total, because they must move completely away from their family patterns. But these young people, too, are being raised in a traditionalist atmosphere. Now, because when we go to Israel, we see the children and grandchildren of our uncles and great uncles and family, European Jews. We do not get into these communities. We do not know them. It is almost as if they do not exist. But if we deal with the future, they will have a great impact, an overwhelming impact on the development of the Israeli community. But of course, the Westernized, secularized Sabra is the dominant type, seems to be the model. And although he is not numerically a majority, he is in terms of stereotypes, of models, of hero images, a majority. And this young Israeli, by and large, does not enter a synagogue except perhaps on his bar mitzvah to satisfy his father or his grandfather or family memories. And bar mitzvah, even when he undertakes it, does not mean even the minimal meaning which it has in many American communities, because it requires no extensive preparation. He speaks Hebrew fluently. He has no trouble reading from the Torah. In a week's time, he can be prepared to read out what must be read. He reads it, and as if he had never been. How Jewish is this Sabra? If we look upon the Sabra in terms of our own judgments of what the Jewish people are, we would say he is minimally Jewish religiously, and that religious component is tending to be drained away. And yet, when we look closer, we discover that the issue is not as we see it. We are trained to think of the non-affiliated, of the disinterested American Jew as by definition ignorant within the Jewish tradition. He does not read Jewish books. He does not listen to Jewish lectures. He is not part of the Jewish community. He does not understand the traditional idiom. And whatever else he knows, he may know a great deal and be a highly sophisticated human being. In things Jewish, he is ignorant. But in Israel, this is not the case. Every Israeli youth speaks Hebrew, the language of our fathers. Every Israeli youth reads as part of the classic training of his elementary and secondary education the Bible. He knows the Bible when he is through far better than most American rabbis. It's second nature to him. He has learned his grammar, he has learned his history, he has learned his language from it. And he has not only read the Bible, but he has read something of the Midrash, he has read something of the Talmud, he has read something of the Code, something of the long tradition of Jewish literature, because this, too, is a required part of his curriculum. He is fluent in Hebrew, he has read the literature, he is identified with the traditional great places of the past, Jerusalem, Bethel, Samaria, he has been there, he knows these places, they are second nature to him. He knows about Jewish life throughout the world because this is what his newspapers are filled with, and he understands many areas of Jewish law because law interferes, impinges upon his life in so many ways. He recaptures Jerusalem, a military achievement. But then there's a religious problem. Now we have in our hands the place, the sacred mountain on which the ancient temple was built. And for 2,000 years and more, the Jews have prayed for the rebuilding of that temple. And it is not to be rebuilt. Why not? To understand the why not, his papers, his periodicals, his literature, his radio, and now even his television is filled with intricate discussions of the Jewish past, of Jewish law, of the tradition. And as he reads these, he absorbs and he comes to understand a great deal. So this Sabra, this non-identifying, religiously identifying Jew, tends to be more literate in things Jewish than the most pious of his temple youth counterpart here in the United States. But beware. And this is the first caveat that Dr. Herman puts up before us. Beware assuming that because one knows, one identifies with. The question in sociology is the valence of knowledge, what one does emotionally with what one knows. Germany, France, and England come out of the same classic European tradition. The countries all emerged from the Catholic Middle Ages. Every member of their establishments read St. Augustine, read Thomas Aquinas, read Dante. They know about each other's history. And if they have fought each other continuously in modern times, one can know without feeling identity with. And the same is true with the Israeli. Because what they know, they integrate in a different way than we integrate. When we are asked the question, we are Jews, but they are blank, we tend to answer Christians, Protestant, Catholic. When he asked the same question in a variety of ways of the Israeli sabras, we are Jews, but they are, the answer was the Hebrew word goyim. Not the Yiddish word goy, but the Hebrew word goyim. A goy is simply any non-Jew. Goyim are the Jewish, non-Jewish nations. We are a nation, they are of the nations. It is Herman's conviction that the basic identity, as far as Jewishness is concerned, around which the young Sabra is fashioning his life, his reactions, his beliefs, is that the Jewish people are a nation. And he sees everything in these terms. I remember once talking with a young Israeli who said to me, you know, it's amazing. For 2,000 years, we had no history. And all of a sudden, everything happened. Well, these 2,000 years, which are a blank to him, are our history. They're Maimonides and Halevi and Ibn Gabira and the Baal Shem Tov and Rashi and 100 Nobel Prize winners. They're all that the Jews have meant to themselves and to the West, and to themselves and to the East. But to the Israeli, it is as if they have never been. His history is the history of his nation. He reads the Bible because it is his natural history, much as we might read about George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. He's not interested in what happened to make us us after the destruction of 70. You read modern Hebrew literature, the historical romance, and who are their great figures? The judges of the Bible, Judah the Maccabee, the Hasmonean kings. The great moment in history is Matsadah, the fortress, the fighting, the courage, the last great hero, Bar Kokhba. And after the last revolt against the enemy, the others, those who would deprive us of our independence, there is a blank. But we have filled that blank, and that they don't understand. So there is a great deal, Herman feels, of misunderstanding by the Israeli of what we understand Jewish life to be all about. One way in which he shows it is this. When asked about Jewish life in the diaspora, in the Galut, they tend to be negative. Not only why don't they come up and join us, but how can they stay in that abysmal condition? When asked why does anti-Semitism exist, 80% of the control group whom we interviewed in depth said anti-Semitism exists because of the action of Jews, by which they meant because the Jew was a coward, because he did not stand up for his rights, because he was craven, because he bowed willingly as a sycophant before the non-Jew, because he accepted 2,000 years of minority living without standing up and as they had stood up and insisting on full political equality, the return to the homeland. They have ticked off the diaspora without any understanding, really, he felt, of the complex of problems, the creativity which went into making diaspora life. They tend then to look down upon the diaspora Jew. An interesting study was done about the reactions of students coming to the Hebrew University. Before they left the United States, they were tested in a whole variety of areas, and all of them felt that there was one great Jewish people who were united in common effort. 2 weeks after they came to the Hebrew University, they retested these youngsters, and they found that a large majority of them were no longer so sure that there was a single Jewish people. They asked them why. And the answer was, because they told us so. They separated us out. They told us we are not part of the continuity. We have opted out. And yes, we'd love you to come now and stay permanently. But if you go back, this is not part of our history. Now, this original study was done in 1965. Why Dr. Herman didn't publish it then, I don't know, but it gave him a chance to look at these youngsters again 5 years later. Two things had happened in the intervening years. They'd grown from 16 to 21, and there'd been the Eichmann trial and the Six-Day War. And these two events, Dr. Herman believes, were traumatic and significant, and they helped him to understand what he believes now will be the ties that bind the communities in and outside of Israel. The Eichmann trial, which we followed in our paper with interest, but not unlike the way in which we followed many of the other trials which had taken place against German war heroes, was for Israel a trauma. An incredibly large number of European Olim, those who'd come up after 45, had never spoken to their children about what things had been like in Europe. They deliberately kept it blank. They didn't want the memories to surface. But here was Eichmann in the glass box in a courtroom. And night after night, the Israeli radio replayed the entire tape of that day's testimony. And in home after home, floodgates of emotion were unleashed. Father, mother, grandfather, grandmother, aunt, uncle, somebody suddenly began to talk about what it had been like. And suddenly the son discovered that his father, this tower of strength, whom he so much loved and admired, had not been one of the great ghetto fighters in Warsaw, Bialystok, but had walked with a mob to the cattle cars and had gone to Rechitokreshenstadt and had somehow survived. Why? How? Because to the Israeli, until the Eichmann trial, to the young Israeli, the Jew who had not stood up, not been strong, was beneath contempt. Why anyone should walk patiently without fighting to the gallows, to the gas chamber, he simply did not understand. But now he had to understand it. And he began to understand something about human dignity. As he heard the testimony of the victims, those of few who had survived, he began to understand the odds, the total environment in which this Shoah, the Holocaust, had taken place. And he began to understand something about its inner reality, that his quick judgments could no longer hold true. But there was something else. The Israeli Secret Service had ferreted Eichmann out and brought him to trial. And this reinforced in the Sabra the feeling that somehow Israel stood in the position of a defender to the Jewish communities throughout the world. They were dependent upon Israel. We were dependent upon Israel somehow for certain kinds of protection. And this sense of noblesse oblige did build some ties, a feeling towards the Jew of the diaspora. A few months later, the Six-Day War took place. Many things happened during the Six-Day War. In the first instance, the Holocaust, the Shoah, the destruction of the 6 million, which had been so much in people's minds, suddenly became a possibility. Dr. Spicehandler a few weeks ago spoke to us about the letters that had been sent home by the soldiers in the war. So many of these letters refer to the Shoah, to the Holocaust. It is now a possibility. And recognizing this, they recognized some basic emotional identity. The Six-Day War also proved to the young Israeli something he was not prepared for, and that is that he was more religious than he had ever dared admit. There's a man by the name of Georges Friedman. Georges Friedman is a French sociologist. Georges Friedman is a humanist. Georges Friedman is a great structuralist as far as his discipline is concerned. He's one of these European Jews who's always fought for every cause except the Jewish cause. He wrote an interesting book, which he called The End of the Jewish People, in 1965. It was done on critical analysis of the Sabras. And what did he say? Among other things, if there is a holy place to which they, the Sabras, are indifferent, it is the Wailing Wall, a symbol of the past, all traces of which, in their view, must be obliterated. And then they found themselves at the wall, and they cried, and they prayed, and they kept coming back to the wall and to the Machpelah in Hebron, and they didn't know why. They were drawn there by the past, they were drawn there somehow by the miracle which is Jerusalem, they were drawn there by God, but they were drawn there. And there was a new awareness of the power of faith in their lives. But more than this, When the Six-Day War broke, two things became clear to the Israeli, young and old. The first is that they were alone, except for the Jewish communities throughout the world. We are interdependent. And not only did we give our money, which so many young people are contemptuous of, but men came, doctors came, volunteers came, people came, Jews came from all over the world, and they haven't stopped coming. And they suddenly recognized that the depth of love for Israel in the heart of the Jew of the diaspora was something that they had not fully contemplated. And more than that, they recognized that the future of the Jews of the diaspora is interdependent with their own. The Jewish communities of the Soviet Union, the Jewish communities of Poland, of Czechoslovakia, and of Hungary suffered because of the victory of the Six-Day War. In the east of Europe, there were organized pogroms, there were organized attack on Jews, because the Jews were defeating Russian Arab purposes in the Middle East. And in the west, the Jews of Paris, the young Jewish students at the Sorbonne, were suddenly singled out and attacked by their extreme liberal radical fellow students. And reading these stories, the Jew in Israel recognized that our lives are truly interdependent. And this brings Hermann to his basic theoretical conclusion. And that is that similarity is not necessarily the best index for the relationship, the level, the love relationship between groups. Interdependence, need, is. That as long as the diaspora and Israel remain interdependent, necessary each to the other, the Israeli will feel Jewish, and the Jew of the diaspora will feel somewhat like an Israeli. And we will overcome the frustrations. We will somehow find a way to understand each other, and it may be to the best that we are dissimilar. Because one of the great visions of the Zionist movement was always that there would be a center in Israel which would be culturally exciting and a center in the diaspora which would be culturally exciting, but we would have different purposes. We live in a non-Jewish world. We have a different kind of mission than the Jew who is master of his own destiny. But there would be interrelation, excitement, ideas would be exchanged. And that is possible as long as the emotional ties remain close. What will be? The simple phrase is, Am Yisrael Chai Klal Yisrael. The talk of unity and identity is obviously very deep in our emotional makeup and the makeup of the average Israeli Jew. Their life is different than ours. They react differently to different stresses. A young American college student who has come through the Vietnam demonstrations of the last several years, who goes to Israel and tries to explain his pacifistic enthusiasm to an Israeli who each weekend must go out to the Sinai front, will be met with great misunderstanding and will probably be called a coward. Why does one withdraw himself voluntarily from the defense of his nation? In Israel, it makes no sense. We're talking about life and death, the immediacy of survival. There will be misunderstanding, there has to be. We face different existential situations. We will use our traditions differently. We live and are formed by the in large part by the image the non-Jewish world has of us, and we must always, for our own purposes, work through the larger community to achieve our desired ends. The Jews of Cleveland cannot of themselves solve the problems of Cleveland. The Jews of Israel must solve the problems of Israel. Their context is a different one. They choose the more heroic, the more action-oriented models. We will choose the more thoughtful, the more subtle, the more flexible models. but we are necessary each to the other. There's an old midrashic phrase that when the Torah was forgotten in Israel, Ezra came down from Babylon and brought it back. And 500 years later, when the Torah was again forgotten in Israel, Hillel came down from Babylon and again brought back the Torah to Israel. A people charged with responsibility with its own destiny has power. And power is corrosive. We have always enjoyed in the diaspora the luxury of being blameless because we were impotent. We could see everyone else's faults. We had no faults. We abused no one. We had no chance to. So we will always be bringing to Israel correction. And Israel will always be saying to us, put your lives where your mouths are. And I suspect in that dialogue, in that tension, is a very healthy kind of relationship which could develop. What will the future be? As you know, I'm an old mystic. I believe that the God of Israel ultimately awakens, that he neither slumbers nor sleeps. I believe that there is a sacred purpose for this people of ours. I believe that we will share a common destiny, but I believe that it will be so only if we make it so. If we are determined to remain close, to understand, to have insight each of the other, to continue that marvelous work which we are now fully engrossed, the mutual support each of the other. Amen.